On April 27th, 1847, just over a month before Thomas Chalmers died, he wrote to an American friend and supporter, "I wish to communicate what to me is the most joyful event in my life. I have been intent for 30 years on the completion of a territorial experiment, and I have now to bless God for the consummation of it." This evening, brothers and sisters, I'd like to share with you the fascinating story behind these words and something of this figure who has captivated my attention and has been the focus of my personal study over several years. It is my hope that you'll get some insight into why I find him and this story in particular both compelling and relevant. Having told the story of the West Port in Edinburgh, I want to share Chalmers' own thinking that led him to advocate and pioneer what he called the parish model for gospel outreach. Perhaps some of you may be familiar with Thomas Chalmers, but by way of brief introduction, he was a Presbyterian minister in the state church in Scotland in the first half of the 19th century. He was actually converted from the cold moralism of what was called moderatism to sincere evangelical Christianity in the midst of his first pastorate. He was actually a pastor when he was converted, after a near-death experience. Having before despised what he considered the fanaticism of preachers such as John Newton, God stepped in, and Chalmers then preached the faith that once he destroyed. Chalmers soon became known for his spellbinding preaching, attracting the attention of the British public and the elite. William Wilberforce once exclaimed, "The world is wild about Chalmers." Chalmers successfully spearheaded an effort to raise funds for 220 new church buildings in poor working class areas of Scotland. He was also known for championing the spiritual independence of the church from state intrusion. In 1843, he courageously led more than 400 ministers of the evangelical wing of the Church of Scotland out of the establishment to form the Free Church of Scotland, and provided masterful administrative guidance of that fledgling denomination after what was called the disruption. It was not without reason, then, that Karl Marx dubbed him the arch-parson. But this opening quote that we just read shows where his deepest desire lay. After conformity to the image of his Savior, Jesus Christ, of course. And that desire was to bring the gospel to the underserved poor of industrial Scotland. First, some backstory. In many respects, this experiment of the Westport experiment would be a repeat of the same model he deployed in St. John's Parish in Glasgow during his ministry there in 1819 to 1823. And then in the Water of Leith in Edinburgh from 1833 to 36. Now, Chalmers was not interested in conducting this missionary experiment in middle-class or upper-class communities of Scotland, but among the poor, or what he called the wastes of home heathenism. By the 1840s, the temporal plight of the urban industrial Scotland had gone from bad to worse. In May of 1844, the British Parliament's Royal Commission of Inquiry into Scottish poor relief shocked the public conscience with reports of unthinkable working-class living conditions. By this time, the public demanded that the government remedy the situation by adopting its version of the English poor laws, that is, legalized poor relief by taxation. This grim assessment only mirrored the religious condition of the poor, which was more to the point for Thomas Chalmers. Parliament had also instituted the Royal Commission on Religious Instruction in the previous decade, would to God the Congress would do likewise, which revealed that one-third of the entire population of Edinburgh was wholly unchurched, while in the working-class areas that number rose to three-fourths. Nor was Edinburgh alone. These numbers basically matched those of London at the time. Religious and social needs cried all the more loudly for intervention. And yet, this experiment of Chalmers would be different. From one angle, the disruption in 1843 severed his church from all state support, which it previously enjoyed. He and his fellow evangelicals would continue to protest this, and yet he could now pursue his project unhindered by the complexities of church patronage and an uncooperative government bureaucracy. Also, a new avenue now seemed open to him for greater ecumenical partnership in missions. There had been bitter rivalries between dissenters and Church of Scotland evangelicals in the 1830s over whether there should be church establishments at all. But now, free churchmen were de facto dissenters, having left the state church. Chalmers was now hopeful that previous hostility could be put aside and all could join together to fight the monster of irreligion and debilitating poverty. Chalmers' final experiment, the Westport experiment, began with a series of lectures in June and July of 1844. In them, he decried British Christendom's abandonment of its working class poor, restated his cherished principles of what he called territorialism as the best solution for their spiritual and social ills, expressed his resolve to spearhead the creation of 66 new working class churches, and summoned a band of volunteers to join in the effort. Here is how it would work. He proposed the formation of societies, comprising 20 volunteers each. Each society would adopt a needy working class district. That district would in turn be divided into 20 sections, or what he called proportions, of 20 contiguous households each. Each of the 20 society members would be assigned to one of the proportions. It would be that member's duty to pay weekly visits to its residents, familiarizing himself with its families. His job would be to ingratiate himself with them that he might effectually promote their spiritual and temporal well-being. Together with this door-to-door household effort, they would spearhead the formation of a school for its children, hire a school teacher, and recruit students who will receive a quality, heavily subsidized education. And they would, of course, work towards the establishment of public ordinances on the Sabbath, hiring a full-time missionary. Now, while Chalmers himself would work to establish a Free Church of Scotland territorial church, this scheme was overtly ecumenical. Dissenters and free churchmen would collaborate. Each society would work towards the formation of a congregation belonging to its respective denomination. On the one hand, this method should stifle petty jealousies and the acrimony so common during the voluntary controversy of the 1830s. And yet at the same time, the scheme would cultivate a healthy fraternal competition. All would strive to outdo each other in love and good deeds for Scotland's poor and neglected. He even explicitly expressed his hopes that this endeavor would result in the blurring and eventual elimination of denominational lines. But Chalmers was not content just to motivate. He would participate, leading at the vanguard. To make his experiment truly worthwhile, Chalmers picked arguably the worst cesspool of industrialized Scotland that he could find, the Westport of Edinburgh. This was the district that had not long before been the scene of the horrific butchery of Burke and Hare. These men lured drunks and other vulnerable people into dark alleyways, killed them, and sold their bodies as cadavers to the University of Edinburgh for medical study. This was a place, dear friends, of almost unimaginable squalor, disease, illiteracy, and crime. There seemed no better place to demonstrate the viability of the urban parish outside of an establishment. By late July, Chalmers had recruited 10 volunteers, 7 of whom were middle-class men from outside the Westport and 3 who lived in it. Together with James Ewan, a dissenting missionary with the Edinburgh City Mission, Chalmers divided the district into 20 proportions of 100 contiguous households each. By January, he had finally enlisted the services of more than 20 workers, thus giving each proportion at least one, if not two, devoted laborers. A survey that his agents conducted that September in the Westport only confirmed the perception of need. Of 411 families and a gross population of 2,000, only 45 families belong to a Protestant church, a tenth of the population. And 70 families were Roman Catholics, no doubt Irish immigrants. Consequently, 296 households had absolutely no church connection whatsoever, though most could hear the church bells of several Sabbath services. A quarter of the entire population were paupers, that is, those on the public roll for poor relief, and a full quarter were given to thievery and prostitution. There were more than 400 children in the Westport, yet only 122 attended school. But these agents saw much more than just disappointing statistics in a ledger. Their walks through the Westport exposed them to heart-wrenching scenes of inhumanity. William Hanna, Thomas Chalmers' son-in-law and biographer, wrote that it was no uncommon thing for William Tasker, the eventual minister of the Westport, when first making his rounds, quote, to find from 20 to 30 men, women, and children huddled together in one putrid dwelling, lying indiscriminately on the floor, waiting the return of the bearer of some well-concocted begging letter, or the coming on of that darkness under which they might sally out to earn by fair means or by foul the purchase money of renewed debauchery. Upon one occasion, he entered a tenement with from 12 to 20 apartments where every human being, man and woman, were so drunk they could not hear their own squalid infants crying in vain to them for food. He purchased some bread for the children. And entering a few minutes afterwards a neighboring dram shop or tavern, he found a half-drunk mother driving a bargain for more whiskey with the very bread which her famishing children should have been eating. He went once to a funeral and found the assembled company also drunk around the corpse that he had to go and beg some sober neighbors to come and carry the coffin to the grave. End quote. The bottom had evidently fallen out of the Westport. Yet every week, this small band of volunteers walked through their proportions, dealing mainly in the one thing needful, the gospel. As Chalmers advised, they read scripture, distributed religious literature, and prayed with the inhabitants. Then they would convene on Saturday evenings to compare notes and to discuss successes and failures. Having strongly dissuaded them from offering financial assistance on their visits, he yet encouraged them to be sensitive to real-life living conditions and needs. They could certainly assist the unemployed in finding work, and they could advocate for them with local authorities to clamp down on public nuisances that fostered waste and vice. Further, they definitely should be creative. Chalmers didn't want to micromanage the operations. The more the agents did their own work, the more it would be obvious that the territorial operation didn't depend on charismatic leaders like Chalmers, and it so was repeatable. Yet above all, they concentrated their benevolent efforts on fostering the classic means of Scottish self-improvement, education. While distributing the bread of life, they sought to arouse interest in the coming district school. They would make education available to the poorest of the poor because all children have the innate potential for academic achievement given the right opportunity. Soon, the Westport Local Society secured a schoolroom. It was a fitting emblem of the district it would serve. William Hanna again writes, quote, it lay at the end of the very close, or alleyway, down which Burke and Hare and his associate decoyed their unconscious victims. Fronting the den in which those horrid murders were committed stood an old deserted tannery, whose upper store loft, approached from without by a flight of projecting wooden stairs, was selected as affording the best accommodation which the neighborhood could supply. Low-roofed and roughly floored, its raw, unplastered walls, pierced at irregular intervals with windows and unshapely form, it had little either of the scholastic or the ecclesiastical in its aspect, unquote. Into this dingy hovel of a schoolhouse, Chalmers called the inhabitants of the West Port to an opening informational meeting on November 6, 1844. In it, he shared the society offered each genuinely West Port family a subsidized quality education for their children. Yet he made clear that each family must contribute a certain amount toward the cost of the schooling. They had to be personally invested in order to appreciate the value of this true long-term boon to their community. Indeed, he said, the society's whole experiment would fail if the residents themselves did not respond to these efforts, cooperate, and become eventual net contributors to the success of their own community. The school then opened the following week on November 11th with 121 students between day and evening classes. The students pursued the subjects of reading, writing, natural science, geography, and the Bible, while the more proficient could further pursue English grammar, Latin, and mathematics. Sabbath services began in the tan loft on December 12th. Initially, there was a sense of anticlimax. Only 12 from the community were in attendance, and most of them were old ladies. Yet, they persevered with three services each Sabbath until Mr. William Tasker, a particularly gifted and coveted Free Church student, responded to Chalmers' personal invitation to serve as the congregation's missionary and eventual minister. Tasker began in April of 1845 and immediately joined Chalmers' side at the head of the Westport experiment. The two became close comrades in arms, and Chalmers found himself enthused once again to be among the humble working classes. The society spearheaded other related projects to help address the outward needs of the Westport poor. These included a savings bank, a library, a public bath and barbering services for the children, a washhouse for laundering, a school to teach females domestic skills, and three Sabbath schools. All of these, of course, were founded exclusively for the benefit of the Westport population, not indiscriminately for any of Edinburgh's poor. Should others wish to help those living outside the Westport, Chalmers replied that they might by all means form new territorial societies and go and do likewise for them. As time progressed, there were most encouraging signs of success. Within a year, the number of school students had doubled to more than 250. By March of 1846, the Sabbath schools had increased to 150 students, and the following illustrates something of Thomas Chalmers' own personal satisfaction, as well as his love of children. On August 6, 1845, the Westport Local Society held a public exhibition in the tannery for a number of prominent Edinburgh citizens, where they toured the facilities and enjoyed a display of the children's academic proficiency. One historian writes, quote, "The day went beautifully. The children performed well. And afterwards, Chalmers joined them for strawberries and cream. A look of benign contentment upon his face as he sat amid the noise and confusion of the excited youngsters," end quote. Hugh Miller wrote in the Witness magazine the following week, quote, "Smile as one might, there is no mistaking the fact that the minds of these children, which save for this school would in all probability have slept on for life, were fully awakened." And in spiritual terms, things were brightening as well. By November of 1845, William Tasker reported that in one section comprising 27 families, 22 of which had lived without any church connection, church attendance at their services sharply increased to 7 families, approaching a third of that population. And yet a still more gladdening index, as he said, of success follows, according to Tasker, quote, that of these 32 individuals, there are a number who give evidence that they have been born again and are now, upon the strength of that conviction, in communion with the visible church and living epistles of Christ, giving light in the darkness. Besides these 7 families, he wrote, there are 6 or 7 occasional hearers giving good reason to hope that they will by and by become regular attenders. Thus, one half of the moral desert has been made to blossom. Fruit, we trust, all pleasing to God is brought forth. And reasoning from analogy, the remaining half will not be so difficult, seeing that coadjutors in such a goodly proportion are now raised up in the midst of themselves. End quote. Thus, on both main fronts, church and school, the experiment was moving in a positive direction. Now, Chalmers originally hoped to have seen funds raised from within the Westport for their own church building. Again, he was after self-sufficiency in the long term. But as that goal seemed yet far away off by the summer of 1845, Chalmers, eager to exhibit a completed experiment for the nation before he went to be with his Lord, decided to purchase land with funds from the society. In January of 1846, he began fundraising in earnest for a building that would adequately accommodate the congregation, school, and the other social programs already underway. The building would be a kind of multi-purpose facility, the fountainhead of ministry to the community and its social center of gravity. Finally, on Friday, February 19, 1847, the completed building was open for its first service of worship. He wrote to Tasker that next Monday, quote, I have got now the desire of my heart. The church is finished. The schools are flourishing. Our ecclesiastical machinery is about complete and all in good working order. God has indeed heard my prayer, and I could now lay down my head in peace and die. On April 25th, the church observed its very first communion. It was 2 days later when he wrote to James Lennox, his American friend and supporter, about this most joyful event in his life, as we opened our lecture this evening. Quote, our church was opened on the 19th of February, and in 1 month, my anxieties respecting an attendance have been set at rest. 5/6 of the sittings have been let. But the best part of it is that 3/4 of these are from the Westport, a locality which 2 years ago had not 1 in 10 churchgoers from the whole population. I presided myself on Sabbath last over its first sacrament. There were 132 communicants, and 100 of them from the Westport. Chalmers felt vindicated, but what is more, he felt wholly satisfied. Now, it should be said that contemporary scholarship, including Stuart Brown, who is the most recent and prominent historian on Chalmers, casts some shadow of doubt on the degree of success of Chalmers' philanthropic efforts, including the Westport experiment. Brown points out that Chalmers significantly underestimated the actual money required for the experiment. He also suggests that the Westport remained just as socially and economically impoverished as before the experiment, and that many of his volunteers began to wane in their energy and drive to fight the impossible in temporal terms. Now, in all fairness, it is possible that Chalmers could have exaggerated the cost effectiveness and success of their educational and social programs. We don't hold up our heroes to a standard above Scripture. It should be said, however, that Chalmers often admitted aspects of failure in his social initiatives, as in the St. John's experiment some 20 to 25 years before in Glasgow. Yet he pointed out that his success in part depended on the cooperativeness of others, including the people themselves and the civil magistrates. His church extension program in the 1830s was a smashing success in many ways, as they raised money and built more than 200 working-class churches throughout Scotland. And yet the entire program's success was mixed in part because Parliament would not ante up and contribute funds for the effort. Furthermore, Chalmers had lost the political battle on state-funded poor relief by the time his Westport experiment was in operation. This, as Chalmers saw it, meant that he would be facing headwinds in the Westport with the degrading influence of what today would be called the welfare state. These things were beyond his control. It is perhaps the case that Chalmers did underestimate the systemic problems unique to his age in the throes of the Industrial Revolution. Just read Charles Dickens. Maybe a purely voluntary initiative was not the answer, at least in its social aspects. Yet, from an ecclesiastical point of view, the Westport was indeed an impressive success. Given the historic Presbyterian caution in counting conversions and its relative rigor in preparing and examining communicant members, the spiked numbers of regular attenders and communicants in the Westport is a testament to the enduring viability of the method that Chalmers proposed. As he had anticipated, the Westport experiment was indeed Chalmers' last great tribute to the parish ideal that he had come personally to love. The very next month, on May 31st, 1847, he was found in bed, having passed in his sleep, gone into glory, his face showing signs only of complacency and peace. A nation forever changed mourned the passing of their loyal son. Now, brothers and sisters, let's take the rest of our time to delve into Chalmers' mind. What was it that made him so passionate as an advocate of what we might call parish missions, and that within free churches of whatever stripe? I'd like to highlight five main elements that I draw from those public lectures he gave in 1844 to drum up interest in the Westport experiment. First, Chalmers argued for what he called the territorial method as a means to the end of home mission. He argued for the territorial method as a means to the end of home mission. Let's start with a quote. "I ought not to speak of it," says Chalmers, "as an innovation, for it is the precious system of the olden time, though it has been grievously departed from. Let me call it now a great home mission, for it is, to all intents and purposes, a missionary enterprise. There are a number of people who will not encourage the work unless it is work across the ocean or over vast continents. But let me remind you that though the distance of the heathen be in this case but half a mile from your own doors, yet morally speaking, it is as great as if they lived in the wilds of Tartary or in the South Sea Islands." Now, let's unpack that. Chalmers was passionate about foreign missions. He personally trained many missionaries at the University of St. Andrews and later at the University of Edinburgh. Many became enthusiastic about it by his zeal. Yet he was tireless about the cause of missions also right at the Scottish doorstep. The church ought to be passionate about the call to go and teach all nations. Yes, they ought to go to Samaria and to the uttermost ends of the earth, as it were, but they must not neglect Jerusalem and Judea. Chalmers spoke a lot about the role of geography in evangelism. The parish method is all about rethinking and reapplying geography. He urged everyone to remember that human beings live in localities, and so we must consequently think locally. And we'll delve into that more in a moment. But when he speaks here of the great moral distance, he's trying to convince people as to why he calls bringing the gospel to the urban poor just as much a mission field as that in Africa or China. It is because these people are spiritually distant from God. If there are church buildings in their vicinity, if it is only a few steps away, it is of no value whatsoever if they are removed in their hearts from it. Or to put it in other words, they may be so close and yet so very, very far. Second, Chalmers advocated this territorial method because it is aggressive and local, not attractive and general. It is aggressive and local, not attractive and general. Let's listen to what Chalmers means by these terms. Quote, where there is a general church and a minister put into it with great powers of oratory, eloquence, and impressive preaching, his fame goes through the city and he attracts people from all points of the compass. You see that here the principle of attraction is put into operation only with those who have a predisposition for Christian instruction, who are supposed to have a previous will, inclination, and demand for Christian instruction. And these people the preacher attracts by the fame of his oratory and fills his church. But with whom? With people who were formerly attending other churches. So that he fills his church at the expense of previous congregations. There is no increase of churchgoers in this process. There is no creation of new worshipers. It is mere transference of the old worshipers to a new place of worship. Now, in this quote, Chalmers explains what he is against when he argues for the territorial or parochial method in missions. He is against the "if you build it, they will come" idea. The idea that outreach is all about simply attracting people by sheer talent and popularity. And that the church has no particular geographic focus of responsibility. Here are some of the problems with this method, said Chalmers. It makes too much of the man and his powers. Is everyone equally gifted? Is everyone a Charles Spurgeon? Is everyone, for that matter, a Thomas Chalmers? Further, while Chalmers was all for laissez-faire principles in economics, the law of supply and demand in the marketplace, yet there is a radical problem with the attractive and general method applied to spiritual things. And here's why. It only attracts those with what he calls a predisposition for Christianity. It only gives a supply with those with a pre-existing demand, if you will, or very simply, for those who are already Christians. This method tends to breed an unwholesome competition between evangelical churches over the same pool of Christians, not unconverted sinners, and in its worst form, indulges in sheep stealing and pandering to the crowd in order to draw numbers. This deeply troubled Chalmers. A further problem is that even a well-intentioned minister on the attractive and general system finds that he simply has no time to reach out to the lost, since his duties are taken up traveling all over the city to the scattered numbers of his communicant church members. His parish, if we could even call it that, is so big that he only has time to visit Christians, in addition to his own study hours. The rest simply falls through the cracks. Gone are the days when the minister would move from house to house where its residents are believers in good standing, having a mostly edifying Christian conversation with them, and then go right next door to the neighbors who are strangers to God. Within 2 hours, he shepherds believers and evangelizes the lost. But within the same 2 hours, the minister on the other system, he shepherds believers, his first priority, of course, but consumes the second hour simply traveling to and from. This, said Chalmers, is not only inefficient, but it tends to make the church insular and non-evangelistic. Those faithful servants of God who operate on that system, says Chalmers, and he didn't begrudge them that respect. He had many good friends who did not necessarily see eye to eye with him. They are successful only despite their method. They could be much more efficient on it, on the one that he proposed. So, what did Chalmers' aggressive and local method entail? He would frequently speak of chalking out a certain urban district of contiguous households and simply treating it as one's parish to win souls and build a Christian community out of nothing. He must not wait for sinners to darken the doorstep of the church or be won over by speaking gifts when they are spiritually deaf. He must go. He must be aggressive. He, with his elders especially, must go and create a demand where none exists. They must go into the highways and hedges and compel them to come in. By adopting a particular locality, one treats it as his own plot, his own acreage, or as Thomas Chalmers often said, his own territorial vineyard. It is manageable. It is not so big that he spreads himself thin. He returns to it again and again and again. Like a diligent farmer, he takes care of it. He ingratiates himself into the hearts and the homes of these people by simply being a Christian friend. What is more, he is a Christian patron. Like a father winning over a wayward son by an array of loving gestures. Now, to be sure, Thomas Chalmers didn't believe that the tactics of love could convert the soul. But the omnipotence of Christian charity, as Chalmers put it, could win their ears and their eventual attendance on the means of grace, at least. Third, his method that he proposed, even within his own Presbyterian men who had forgotten some of these principles, this method capitalizes on the gregarious principle. The gregarious principle. Speaking of the influence of neighborhood, he observed, imagine when one family is persuaded to go to a well-known church to hear a minister who is also well-known in the neighborhood. If one family thus gives in, it furnishes a common topic of talk to all the neighborhood. Sympathy is excited, for there is much sympathy in the mere fact of juxtaposition. There can be no sympathy between hearers, all who are half a mile distant from each other, but there is much sympathy among next-door neighbors. This brings the gregarious principle into play. What people will not do singly, they do with delight and readiness in a flock. I think we can see that Chalmers was a close student of human nature. And he didn't only study human nature theologically, but also psychologically and sociologically. How do people tick? Let's tap into that for evangelism, he reasoned. Let's harness their natural sympathy. If, however, you work on the attractive and general principle, said Chalmers, you lose the power of sympathy. If you try to build a fire by igniting several sticks several feet apart from each other, it will be slow going indeed. But try to build a fire with several sticks laid together, and if one catches, the rest well may follow. Imitation and example just may be a harbinger of even better things. Fourth, the haves must support the have-nots in missions. The haves must support the have-nots in missions. Again, we must remember that territorialism for Chalmers was a means to the end of home missions. All missions cost something. It must be subsidized. The heathen will not pay for these religious services on their own. They may be too poor to afford a godly, well-trained missionary. But what is more, until they're converted, they lack the very interest to pay any of the costs associated with the missionary. The exact same thing applies in the case of home missions. If lost sinners at our own doorsteps will be systematically reached and not simply sporadically, if at all, then a minister of the gospel must regularly dedicate some of his time to reach them. That time is worth something, and it must be underwritten to some degree. And certainly no home missionary devoting himself exclusively to planting a church can do this without being supported by Christians of goodwill, who pay both for their own regular pastoral care as well as that of others who don't even care about pastoral care. At least, not yet. Non-territorial churches, said Chalmers, have a tendency to become insular or non-missionary. A minister is called to a body of those who are already Christians and who, at least in normal cases, together can pay a salary for their ministry. That is fine and good, of course, thought Chalmers. The laborer is worthy of his wages. But all too very easily can that minister find himself wholly unable to devote even a fraction of his time to creating a local parish ministry simply because the duties of his congregation crowd all of that out. Again, we are reminded of his critique of the other method because of its inefficiencies. He didn't bear any animus to these people. He wanted them to be efficient. The more the payers are scattered far and wide, the more exclusive his pastoral time will be confined to those who are already Christians. Fifth, the system that he promoted and which he personally threw himself into in the last stage of his life in the Westport. This system was popular and comprehensive, not selective. This naturally leads into another key principle for Thomas Chalmers. The Church on Home Mission is a national church. Now, we're not going to get down into the weeds of whether or not there should be formally national churches, but I'm using a lowercase n tonight, if you will. And by that, I think Chalmers would suggest that a truly national church is content with nothing short of the entire nation for Jesus Christ. Yes, that church ministers to the rich. Yes, it ministers to the middle class. Most of the Free Church of Scotland's material support came from the middle class. To give them short shrift would have been both an insult and an injustice. But a nationally minded church serves the lower classes as well, who often fall through the cracks. The church of a nation must not neglect or cater only to some. Did not the Apostle Paul confess that he was debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, to the wise and to the unwise? But a middle-class church like Thomas Chalmers' own Free Church must ever be careful not to bypass the lower classes. To do so reflects a partiality to the haves that the Apostle James condemned. Chalmers rebuked the negligence of the church of his own day to the poor, warning of dire consequences. And the following words really are prophetic. Quote, "People may speak of the immorality of the lower orders, of their being abandoned to depravity and of their degeneracy as they like. But I say that the charge lies at our own doors, that it is because we have cruelly neglected the population that they have sunk into their present state of hardihood and degeneracy. And I say farther that there is a smoldering flame gathering at the bottom of the social edifice, which, if it be not speedily met and extinguished, will upheave the social edifice from its base and overthrow all the institutions of the country." End quote. It is worth remembering that according to the Apostle, not many rich, not many of noble blood are called. Quote, "Realize what our Savior has said," said Chalmers, "to the poor the gospel is preached. And remember that you deviate from the spirit of these words if you put off the poor with less than an efficient ministry and an efficient ecclesiastical apparatus." End quote. Sixth. Last, the system facilitates constructive long-term poverty relief. Now, this last point is worth an entire lecture, if not a book in itself, and others have written on the subject. But let me try to state it simply in a few words. For Chalmers, don't be confused. The church is not a social agency. It is a spiritual institution. the territorial ministers and elders go among the population of their territorial vineyard dealing mainly in one article, said Chalmers, Christianity. And yet, those most able to help alleviate poverty are stable, mature Christians. The best patrons of the poor, in temporal terms, is not the government bureaucracy, but those men and women, and especially those men whom the church has proven to be honored with its finances, the deacons. If a deacon, after caring for communicant members and their families, follows up the lead of the ministers and elders in a working class parish, he can most constructively help them in outward things. By visiting them periodically, he gets to know them. By simply getting to know someone, the risk of fraudulent appeals for money declines. He can help them get employment when they need it. He can help negligent relatives to come to the rescue of their faltering family. And when a parish school is built and running for the families of that district, said Chalmers, he and the teachers can be involved in the education of their children, which is the best long-term investment to combat poverty. Now, as we close, just how might some of this apply in the present context? Things are quite different today, I think we would all acknowledge, in a post-Christian, post-industrial, highly mobile, and technological 21st century America. I think that's beyond dispute. But let me outline a few things, at least for our prayerful consideration, if nothing more. First, all of us as Christians should strive to think more missionally, and I think that only echoes what we have heard in our first, most edifying and challenging lecture. We should not get stuck in a bunker mentality. We shouldn't want to remain some little subculture into which we can escape each Lord's Day. But we should also think strategically. And as a part of that, we should think geographically. Where has God placed us as a church? Where do we meet for worship? In what communities do we actually live? What can we do as a church to bring the gospel to those communities without pandering or sacrificing our principles? We are in Rhode Island, at least most of us. We have certain people in our lives, certain connections, certain family members. We live in certain areas and certain neighborhoods with certain cultures and certain subcultures. There are certain fields, wide into harvest. Many are within walking distance, and most points of the state are reached, of course, as we all know, within 30 minutes. Before going to battle, I think Chalmers would say to us, we need to do some reconnaissance. Second, we should dream big and work small. Dream big and work small. That is, we should seek to conquer the state and nation for Christ and start not with some huge, splashy, massive effort, but in littles, said Chalmers. There is power in littles. If we dream big and work small, zealously, perseveringly, and prayerfully, then who knows what the Lord may do? Now, here is the reality for us today. For many of us, we drive 15 to 30 minutes to church, give or take. Our buildings are more often than not simply a geographical center for our believing members, and we often have very little presence where we worship. We are one of arguably several Reformed or Calvinistic churches in Rhode Island, and let's just be honest, we're not the hottest commodity in church going these days. That is what it is. But someday, I want to walk to church like our ancestors did, with my children and my grandchildren. And I want to walk to church because God has poured out His Spirit through our earnest prayers and diligent labors to expand His kingdom, house by house, community by community, starting with a small group of people right in my own local church. I would love to see preaching stations and full-fledged Reformed congregations mushrooming throughout Rhode Island. I would love to see us effectively reaching all the types and all the varieties of the Ocean State, the Italians, the Irish, the Romanists, the liberal Protestants, college communities, from the privileged in Barrington to recent immigrants, drunks, and welfare recipients in Central Falls. But we will not get there unless we are willing to dream big and work small and doggedly stick with it. Third, church leaders should lead the way. Chalmers was not a theorist only. He was a man who rolled up his sleeves and went into communities where no one else wanted to go. But in those communities, God had his people. I am confident, were Chalmers here, that he would urge them seriously to consider chalking out their own little parishes. Presbyterian, Baptist, Lutheran, whatever the stripe, if they have the gospel of Jesus Christ, chalk out your own little district, claim it for the Lord Jesus Christ, and set to work. No doubt they should bear the gospel to those in their circles of daily life, such as work associates and family. But what about their neighbors? Could they not chalk out 5 or 6 households immediately surrounding them to begin building relationships with a view to bringing them to Christ? This could be their own little parish and their home, their mission base. The same really could be said for every church member in a sense. One man once asked the Lord, "And who is my neighbor?" Sadly, we often must ask the same question because we actually don't even know our neighbors. Or at best, they are just passing acquaintances. But it just so happens that God has put us in certain neighborhoods and not by accident. What would happen if each of us began adopting our neighbors in our hearts, praying for them, looking for ways to thaw the ice and eventually to bring the gospel to them? And if just one of our neighbors gets converted and starts coming to church, already a small center of gravity is formed in one of our family's neighborhoods. The genesis, perhaps, of a parish church. Fourth, church leaders should seriously consider creating, if you will, a parish either immediately surrounding their church building or in a working class area or both. The reason why a district immediately next to the church should be obvious. But Chalmers would very much want to persuade church leaders to at least think about chalking out a district, however small, in the working class and the poor, among the poor, precisely because if they don't, who will? To be sure, there is a myriad of social and political problems surrounding the inner city. But watching the inner city implode from the sidelines will not help anything. Godly volunteers are needed, not more programs, and certainly not more money. Fifth and last, we must pray, pray, and pray again. Chalmers knew well that no method would avail, that any method, however promising, would prove a dry well without the Holy Spirit's sovereign activity. Not by might, nor by power, but by my Spirit, saith the Lord. And therefore we must bathe all our missionary efforts in passionate, habitual, believing prayer. Let us add, brothers and sisters, supplication to strategy, tears to toil. And as John Eliot, who labored among the Indians some centuries ago, whom Chalmers often quoted, said, "Prayer to pains." Amen. Shall we close in prayer?